This week on The Conversation, we've been talking about disruptive technologies. Right now, there's a fierce battle brewing between the city and a company known as Lime, or Lime Bikes. The city put the company on notice, saying it considers their electric scooters operating on our streets as mopeds and therefore subject to all kinds of restrictions. Honolulu police have impounded about 90 of those scooters this week. The city will return the scooters to Lime under threat that if they flagrantly disregard the warning, it will levy fines and continue to seize the vehicles. Mayor Kirk Caldwell says he is hearing a barrage of complaints from business and residents about those surprise scooters.
I hear it when I go into Waikiki, when I meet with the hotel operators. This is dangerous. It's impacting how people travel, and it's just cluttering a place that's already very crowded. And they've asked us to take action. I'm sure that's why the council member from that area did too. But I know that members of the neighborhood board for Waikiki are very upset that no one reached out to them to tell them they're going to do this. You know, we as an administration try to go before the neighborhood boards to inform them before action is taken. These guys just showed up. And so you've interviewed and heard from some of those members of the board. How come we weren't told, didn't get our input? But, you know, one of the condominium managers in that area say they're entering our private property without a permission. A local resident says the Alawai has four scooters in the middle of the sidewalk. That's unbelievable. Another two residents called and said the same thing. This is out of control. Mayor, what are you going to do about it? A Diamond Head resident says she's concerned about pedestrian safety, saying there are too many scooters going too fast on the sidewalk. She's afraid she's going to get hit. And these are just some of the complaints that we're hearing from people. And particularly some of the large resort properties saying they're on our property and they're making money. They didn't even knock and say, can we come in and how do we work with you? They just came in.
Caldwell criticizes the company for its way of doing business in Hawaii and calls the problems being created a waste of police time and city resources. The city sent a letter to company officials yesterday outlining its position.
And I'm willing to show good faith, but Lime Bike needs to too. And they need to rebuild trust, which is not there whatsoever. So continuing to do what they're doing and not change their approach doesn't go anywhere close to the trust we're requesting. And we're not going to work with them until they step back, stop what they're doing, and say, we want to get this right with the city and county of Honolulu. And what do we need to do to get it right? Until then, they show this continued bad faith. We set a bad example for others to come in and say, disregard the laws, do whatever you want, and then ask for forgiveness and continue to do it. That is not acceptable and will not happen here in the city and county of Honolulu.
The city's top lawyer, Donna Leong, explained why the city believes the scooters fall under the category of mopeds, subject to requirements of registration, limitations on where they can be driven, and where they can be parked.
These electric scooters are considered mopeds because people can ride on them. They have two wheels, and a moped has to have two or three wheels. They have an electric motor whose maximum power output is 1,492 watts. And these scooters, according to the linebike.com website, is 250 watts. And the reason for that limitation on the power is so that they don't get classified as something like a motor scooter or a motorcycle or a car. The maximum speed of these scooters is 14.8 miles, and the law requires the maximum speed to be 30 miles per hour or less. So again, so that it's not classified in a higher vehicle classification. And then the scooters have a direct or automatic power drive system with no clutch or gear shift that operation by the moped driver after the drive system is engaged with the power unit.
Okay, so based on that, you folks are classifying it as a moped.
Yeah. You know, so we've taken a close look of the definition of mopeds under HRS section 249-1, and this applying the facts of these scooters to that statutory definition, they would fall within that definition.
And did the city have any discussions about the concern that an operation like this could drop in on the city and just start operating like it has in other cities?
Well, as I think we mentioned, right, there was some letter trading late last week, and we asked them not to put their scooters on the streets and sidewalks. And then over the weekend, they deployed 100 to 200 of the electric scooters, such that altogether they deployed 200. So there wasn't any discussion. They just deployed over the weekend.
Right, but I mean, as I mentioned in there, I mean, we've seen these news reports since the beginning of the year about how they just, you know, they're like rogue operations.
Yeah.
You know, they just jump into town and disrupt everything and then really kind of push the envelope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Mayor answered that question, right? He's looking forward. They should be coming and talking to the city administration about doing their operations, and they haven't done that.
That was City Attorney Donna Leong, and Acting Deputy Police Chief Alan Nagata told HPR that HPD officers will continue to respond to the nuisance and safety complaints as they have been doing all week.
We responded over the weekend to public nuisance complaints, and what it was blocking the sidewalk. And what we found was scooters were in the sidewalk, impeding the walkway for pedestrians and like even wheelchairs. So we rounded up about maybe close to 80 to 100 up till now. And keep in mind, we also received complaints from private property owners who found those scooters on their property and had no idea where they came from.
Yeah, yeah.
That was Acting Deputy Police Chief Alan Nagata speaking at a news conference yesterday afternoon. We reached out to Lyme representatives in town this week, and they issued a statement as follows. Given the administration's recent comments, we are conducting our own legal review to determine next steps out of caution for our users and employees. Lyme officials say they have hired 15 people here in Hawaii to collect the scooters, which use GPS dockless technology. Honolulu's enforcement action comes on the heels of that in other cities like San Francisco and Miami Beach.
And following Wednesday's show, when I spoke with Lyme's Honolulu Government Affairs Manager, Sam Dreeman, a lot of you had things to share on our talkback line.
Hi, Norm from Kahana Bay on Oahu. And I'm disappointed you didn't mention that the city and the state had each given $1 million to help fund that bike sharing program. And there may be a conflict of interest with the city going after their own competition.
Hi, my name's Matt McComas, calling from Honolulu. I recently traveled to Seattle and San Diego, and they had the rollout of the Lyme bikes everywhere, all over the streets and all over the sidewalks, and it was very disorganized, and I just hate to see that happen to Honolulu. Thank you. Goodbye.
Hi, my name is Kelly Helps from Honolulu. I was listening to the spokesman for the Lyme scooter startup, and I found myself laughing every time your host asked a question. He gave an answer with a spin of how he wanted to answer the question. That's part of startup culture. I'm originally from the Bay Area. I've been around a lot of startup cultures, and unfortunately, there's a lot of arrogance and a lot of we don't need any regulation. I commend the mayor, Kirk Caldwell, for kind of standing up to this event and saying, hey, you need to be regulated. You can't come in here and do whatever you want. Thank you.
Aloha, this is Indy calling from Kapahulu Avenue. My only experience with motorized scooters was in the last several days, perhaps yesterday, and they were extraordinarily dangerous in traffic lanes, crossing traffic lanes, zipping in and out, no apparent concern for their own safety or that of others. Go ahead and keep them illegal. Mahalo and aloha.
We also heard feedback on Facebook from our listeners. John says the program is fantastic. We need to iron out the issues because this is a step in the right direction for an island with a congestion issue. And Micah submitted this. Today on my way home, I saw two of them parked on the sidewalk, and they were completely blocking the way. Anyone with a stroller or in a wheelchair would have to move them before being able to continue along the sidewalk.
We thank you for that feedback, and you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, which is 808-792-8217. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, Hawaii Island farmers work to protect their crops from Kilauea's toxic gases. But first, your quiz.
Many of you are familiar with the famous Hawaii Five-O theme song that was composed by Morton Stevens. The song was originally recorded by the musical group Ventures as an instrumental theme for the long-running police drama. It became such a hit that it found its way all the way to the United Kingdom. The dance floor scene of the late 1960s mod scene had given way to the soul-funk sound. The unique sounds were dubbed a genre built from failures. As the music and dance movement helped the rest of the world embrace the lesser-known black American soul artists who copied the early Motown sound, the Hawaii Five-O theme was also the last song with the word Hawaii in it to make the Hot 100 of the era. America had a fascination with Hawaiian culture in the 50s and 60s, and it was being reflected in movies, TV shows, and music. But did you know that the song also has a lyrical version? It's been performed by two prominent artists, the local favorite Don Ho and another one. Do you know who that second artist is? Here's a hint. He's not just a musician. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
If you get in trouble, bring it home to me. Whether I am near you or across the sea, I will think of something to do. I'll be on the lookout for you and I'll find you. You can count on me. And don't you let them get you.
Kilauea volcano shows no sign of stopping its spew of ash and gas. Farmers in the drift of the sulfur dioxide are scrambling to deal with the detrimental effects on their crops. Kelvin Sawaki is from the University of Hawaii's College of Tropical Agriculture, and he's been fielding the calls for help from coffee and orchid farmers.
Well, the calls from the farmers have been mostly on, you know, seeing the crop damage and what can they do about it, you know. And so, you know, I've seen some photos that have come into my office on orchids, for example, where the dendrobium orchid plants are just basically burned off by acid rain or SO2 gas or both, where leaves should be nice and yellow and stems, you know, on the orchid plant, on dendrobium orchid, should be nice and green. I mean, to be green, they're actually all yellow, you know, now. An entire crop, pretty much. And burning on the leaves, burning to the flowers, some of the other crops, papayas and stuff like that, where they just have the tops of the papaya plants that are just gone, burned off by the acid rain. And there's a lot of other, you know, crops that are being grown, veg crops out that side, where leaves are turning brown and getting burned, and also on foliage plants out there, ornamental foliage crops.
So what can farmers do?
Well, you know, if they can, what we suggest, and there's really no, you know, real scientific information out there that shows exactly what to do about it. But when you try to reverse an acid rain type of situation, the thing to do is to look at the possibility of trying to use a bicarbonate to reverse the effect of the acidity to make the acid rain more pH neutral, or, you know, move it away from the acidic side. And so what we suggest people can try is by putting a bicarbonate into their water, like calcium carbonate, or you know, spray a product. Say, for example, there's a product out there, you know, which is a potassium bicarbonate that they can spray on their plants. And hopefully it would help to reverse the acidic effects of the acid rain. However, you know, with the SO2 gas, that presents another challenge, another problem, in that once the sulfur dioxide gets into the stomates or the openings of the leaves, what's going to happen is that the mesophyll layers in there, the SO2 will contact that, which are moisture, you know, holding cells and things like that, and it'll turn to sulfuric acid within the leaf, and so it can cause burning as the SO2 gas gets inside. So it's kind of a double whammy, I guess, you know, where you have acid rain falling on the leaves, and you also have the SO2 gas getting into the leaves through their stomates. And in both cases, it'll cause the same effect. You'll have burning on the leaves.
I've seen some of the aerial photos, and what was green and lush is really black.
Yes, and I saw those aerial photos also, you know, and the change of where, you know, a region was green and then you see it now where it's turning brown and black. Those symptoms are very typical of what we saw back in 2008 when Halemaumau had started, you know, releasing a lot of volcanic emissions. And the communities downwind saw their vegetation basically turn brown right in front of their eyes. With the VOG itself, you know, it doesn't take a lot of high concentration of SO2 necessarily to cause plant damage. We've seen what we think runs anywhere from 2 to 4 parts per million, and exposure at 30 minutes time could start to cause burning on those plants that are sensitive. And a lot of plants are sensitive. In CTAR, in our college, we had done a publication back in 2008 that shows volcanic emissions injury to plant foliage. And in that, we show a lot of different plant species that have been affected by this SO2 gas. And so, you know, everything from flowers and ornamentals to fruit and nut crops to a lot of our native plants that are there in our forests have been affected by it. Vegetable crops, grasses, a wide variety of plants.
How does coffee fare?
Coffee did pretty well, actually, from what we saw at that time, at the SO2 levels that were coming in at the time. And we observed, you know, other crops getting damaged, but coffee seemed to do pretty well with the SO2. And also tea, you know, tea, the drinking kind of tea, also did pretty well. It stood up pretty well against the SO2 levels that were there present in 2008.
So if the crops right now on the ground are affected, the leaves are burned, does that mean the plants are just useless after that, or is there a chance they could recover and rebound?
Some plants, there's a chance. You know, for example, the proteas that were affected in 2008, although the plants looked, you know, pretty much dead because the whole plant looked brown, some of the plants were able to recover after, you know, the SO2 mm-hmm. emissions had stopped. So there is some chance that some of the plants, if they're well-rooted, If some of these trees and others, they may be able to come back again. Some of the more sensitive herbaceous plants perhaps may not, you know. But I think there is a chance for some of those that are deeply rooted, that are more woody type plants. They may lose leaves and stuff, but I think that they have a chance to recover.
What about the pasture lands? Because we did talk with a veterinarian who you know, kind of walked us through the evacuations of the cattle and the logistic challenges with that. But what about their return to the ranch lands down there?
So a concern for the livestock producers, you know, are for those that many of the livestock are range, you know, grass-fed beef, for example. There is a possibility of fluorine that comes out as the emission from the volcanic activity. Fluorine to get onto forage crops, onto the grasses, and if the animals start to ingest a large amount, it could cause problem for livestock. So that is a potential problem. Even after the air clears, you know, and they start moving livestock back onto the ranches, one thing they'd have to do, and we suggest that they do some tissue and soil sampling. And, you know, for testing for especially, like, you know, some of the heavy metals and for fluorine that would go into the crops. So our college will do testing of heavy metals, and we can provide those kind of services for the different growers and for the ranchers. And so what I would suggest is that if anyone has a need for that kind of service, to you know, contact our offices on the Big Island, and find out about the testing service and what we can provide. So, you know, normally we charge for our costs or for our services. There is a cost. But in this case, under this emergency situation, we're going to be temporarily waiving the cost for those that are affected by volcanic activity.
And recently we had the disaster declaration for agriculture properties on Kauai. What do you suggest that farmers do on the Big Island?
Sure. Farmers can contact the Farm Service Agency. That's part of the United States Department of Ag program, where the Farm Service Agency provides a number of crop insurance programs for those farmers that get impacted by this kind of natural disaster. And so by contacting that office, the Farm Service Agency office, for those on the Big Island, that would be in Hilo, of course, and they'd be able to go out and they can do, you know, the assessment of the damage and start to collect this kind of information and hopefully provide some funding assistance down the road.
Okay. Anything else you think is important to stress?
Just basically, you know, pay attention to the different information that's coming out, because there's a lot of information now that's going out, I see, on the Internet from many different agencies, Department of Health, Department of Agriculture, our college, CTAR. We've put up on CTAR a website to help those affected by this volcanic emissions.
That was Kelvin Siwaki from the University of Hawaii College of Tropical Agriculture. You can find links to information dealing with the impacts for farm crops, livestock, and wildlife. Check our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Local people are serious about free public access to beaches. It's more than a long-standing tradition. It's the law. So when a luxury condo began setting aside space in Ala Moana Regional Park for the exclusive use of its residents, longtime beachgoers saw an attempt to commercialize the beach. Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Natanya Friedheim has that story in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Natanya.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. What is it that this particular condo, what is it, the Park Lane, is offering?
So this condominium has a service to its residents where it's sort of like a beach caddy. People will take some beach toys like stand-up paddle boards. They'll lay out a towel on the beach with some chairs, umbrellas. And from the people I've talked to, regulars at the beach, they say, I have actually not seen this myself, but they say they'll lay out this nice, pristine-looking beach setup and then wait until the residents who are requesting the service actually come down to the beach and use it. So they'll set it up, and the people I've talked to have seen them wait for, you know, 30 or 45 minutes, and the setup will just be there, you know, waiting for the residents to come enjoy it.
And presumably, if you came into this space and you have a photo on the Civil Beat website of these two nice little chairs, a little table, mm-hmm. neatly packed towels, even a cooler, a couple of paddle boards. I'm assuming that one of the condo employees would shoo people away if they tried to occupy that space. So they're holding it for the client to come down, right?
That's the idea, and that's what concerned some of the regulars who use Ala Moana Beach. It's actually there's a name for this practice. It's called pre-setting. And if you've ever walked down Waikiki Beach, there's there's sections of the beach that are full of beach chairs, you know, like lounge chairs. Ko'olina Resort, the beaches over there have a lot of them too. And that's a different story because the ownership is different on the beach. So the rules are different. But this is a city park. So yeah. There's a different sense of, I think, public space here.
There's always been we've seen a number of examples of sort of gray area commercial activities operating on public property and not always regulated, not always with the city paying much attention, yeah?
Definitely. And, you know, the cases that I have looked into and cited, you know, Ko'olina and Waikiki, there's also an issue on Kahala, in front of the Kahala Resort. But those are all either privately owned or part of the Department of Land and Natural Resources. This is a city park, so there are very specific rules set out. I mean, the city has so many activities that require regulations. Playing a tuba or maracas, for example, requires a permit.
Really?
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And for commercial activities, there are very specific laws. The city allows photography, paddleboarding, surf lessons, and then scuba and snorkeling tours. Those are the things that you can get a commercial permit for. And I did reach out to the city, and they said that Park Lane is, you know, they confirmed that Park Lane is following rules here, and they don't need to have a permit for this activity. And the reasoning is because the beach is, you know, it's for a first-come, first-serve basis.
Sure. Well, pretty interesting story. My mind is reeling from that need for a license to play the tuba, but I suppose we'll find out more about that in the future. Thanks very much, Natanya.
Thanks for having me.
That was reporter Natanya Friedheim with today's reality check from Civil Beat. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Chaminade University, Inter Island Solar Supply, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
Congratulations, fellow Americans. The plan codenamed Windsor Whammy has come to fruition. Our agent has successfully infiltrated the royal family, and once all other claimants to the throne are eliminated, she shall take over the United Kingdom and force them to say aluminum the normal way. I'm Peter Sagal. We'll celebrate a win and talk to music icon Cyndi Lauper about how she likes to have fun on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday morning at 11.
Alexis Strauss, acting administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency for the Pacific Region, Region 9, is in town checking in on Hawaii's progress with clean water and clean air programs. She sat down with us yesterday to talk about where we're headed on a myriad of hot-button issues.
We have been working on cesspool closure for some time now. We at EPA are on a mission to close all of the large capacity cesspools that were banned under federal law. And of those large capacity cesspools, there were about 4,900 in Hawaii, and we've closed more than 70% of them through taking enforcement action and the like. But there are a lot of others. There are smaller cesspools, as the legislature here has recognized, and there are about 88,000 of them. So we have to come up with some strategies of how can we help communities with different solutions. How can we help solve the funding conundrum? And we have some ideas that we've been discussing with our partners here.
Right. And the lawmakers have tried to offer incentives. There's been pushback from the real estate industry. And, you know, they tried to do point of sale issues to be able to try and, you know, make this a little bit easier for homeowners. But it's going to take a while.
It will, but I think that we have some good ideas. For example, EPA capitalizes loans to the state, the state revolving fund that gets loaned out to the counties at a very reasonable rate. And if the county became the sponsor of a large cesspool project involving multiple homes in a neighborhood, it's possible that they could undertake replacing the small Ohana-style cesspools and connect people maybe to a small package plant or the like, but spread it out over a 20-year period of the loan repayment, which makes it more affordable.
And we're one of the last communities to really struggle with this, but how have other places dealt with priorities? Like, obviously, we're an island, so I know lawmakers tried to focus on the properties that would be more of a threat, like along the shoreline.
It would be vital because 90% of the drinking water in Hawaii comes from groundwater, and we're very concerned that where most people live near the coast, where we have this abundance of cesspools, we want to make sure that we're not contaminating groundwater.
And so your visit here, you're meeting with various stakeholders. You met with the governor's office. Explain what's on tap there.
We're talking about how can we work together around moving EPA infrastructure money into projects here, such as cesspool replacement projects, and make them affordable over the long term. How can we make sure that all of the coastal discharge permits from wastewater treatment plants are going to be in effect and protecting coastal waters? There's so many things. We are very focused at EPA on protecting agricultural workers. We have the largest complement of agricultural workers of anywhere in the country, and there are unique facets to Hawaii agriculture. So I'm looking forward to talking more with the Hawaii Farm Bureau and talking about how can we ensure that growers, large and small, are all in compliance with the worker protection standard.
Right, because recently we had a case here where the workers went into a field that had just been treated, and I think they ended up in the hospital.
Indeed. And so we worked with Hawaii Department of Agriculture and took enforcement action in that matter and others. We have some fantastic projects that are growing out of that settlement in which small growers will be targeted in all the different languages that are spoken in Hawaii agriculture and in the territories, so that we can get these training materials out there in languages that people can understand, and then we can make that material available on the web to people elsewhere in the world.
Right, and there's lots of concern, I think, particularly on Maui, about the drift of pesticides.
And this is not unique to Hawaii, but what is unique is the growing season. You know, compared to other places in the country where there might be one growing season, we have almost a year-round growing season. And so there's a lot more intensive use of a wide variety of pesticides. And our goal is not only to implement protections for agricultural workers, but to make sure that the hazards to homes and schools nearby do not occur.
And then we've got the volcano rumbling. how are you looking at that situation?
I am coming off months of us working on the Northern California wildfires at the household level. And so we've got 9 people on the Big Island. FEMA has asked us to contribute air monitoring expertise. I'm very concerned about people being able to return to their homes. That's the most profound and basic need to be met. And so anything that we can do to support the county, to support the state and FEMA, give people risk information about the air quality, take a lot of data that is being gathered every day and make it available to the public in a way that's understandable, bring more air monitors if that's what's needed, bring more expertise. So we're very happy to support this and are very hopeful. You know, coming on the heels of the Kauai flooding, where there are great needs there too, I want to bear in mind that whatever we can do to make this better.
And the team that you've got on the Big Island, are they additional boots on the ground, or are they just staff that was here on Oahu that's being dispatched?
No. In addition to our amazing public information officer, who is an important relay point of what is needed, we have on-scene coordinators and those who are accustomed to working in these hazardous situations, who are there to support. And as needed, if we need to bring more air monitoring equipment from the mainland, that's what we'll do.
Wow. Okay. So really, you're here hitting a lot of different issues. As you mentioned, we had the flooding on Kauai. We had flooding here on Oahu. And I know there was concern about, the runoff, the storm drain capacity. And I know that's another issue that's kind of at the forefront of the EPA as well.
It is. And we, with the State Department of Health Services, regulate stormwater runoff through these big municipal permits. And it's very important that that be an effective tool at the county level to keep sediment and all of the things that move with sediment out of coastal waters. We want to protect coral reefs, not have them drown in sediment.
There's also concern locally about the Red Hill underground fuel tanks that the military has, and there's been lots of back and forth with the work plan, the action plan. Where are we at with that?
This is a very important year. The Navy has been looking at alternatives, and at the end of this calendar year is going to be very close to making a decision about what should that fuel storage infrastructure look like for the longer term. I'm going to be talking about that with Admiral Fort. And our team is working very closely with them, with the state, with Defense Logistics Agency and other partners like Board of Water Supply about what makes sense going forward. I know that we will be very much engaged with the public of talking about options and understanding what an important issue this is for Honolulu. We need to make sure that we're protecting groundwater and drinking water for generations to come, and at the same time, the Navy facility plays a critical role in America's defenses and strategic interests. So how can we achieve that happy blend of many different objectives? And EPA will continue to be a very strong partner in leading this effort.
And as far as the additional monitoring that's happening, I know the military has added other monitoring wells to protect the aquifer, just to make sure that there isn't any, that whatever fuel that has been leaked isn't making its way toward the aquifers.
Indeed. And I got to see some of the tools and particularly the way that they have stepped up their operations and maintenance and measurement practices is really impressive. The controls they have in place, the leak detection mechanisms they have in place, it's extraordinary. And I think that also, this fuel storage facility is extraordinary. There's nothing else like it. So I'm confident that we can deal with many of the technical issues in front of us, but more importantly, we need to bring along public understanding and a conversation of whatever the future remedy will be.
And as far as funding for that, I know we're on a timetable, but is there any sense that you're getting that if things can be fast-tracked, that they will?
I think the key will be at the end of this year, the Navy will have a preference of whatever option or hybrid of options comes forward.
Or whether it's double mining.
Indeed, or a mix of different things, and that will have an estimate. And then once the Navy has resolved with Congress as to how to move forward with that, I think more detailed cost estimates will come when you're actually in the process of design and construction. You know, it's like remodeling your kitchen. There's what you think at the front end and what you end up knowing at the other end.
And it always takes longer than you think.
It does. But I do think that there's a very strong and committed team here. And EPA will always be a part of this project and see it through to the close.
And will the public then be able to weigh in on those options at the end when the military makes its announcement?
Indeed. If anyone were to look at the EPA administrative order that we signed with the Navy, Defense Logistics, and the state, it's very clear that there is a public engagement process to come, and I want that to be meaningful.
Okay. Anything else that you think is important to kind of impress as you spend more time out here?
I'm very happy to be supporting the goals of sustainability for the islands, both in terms of transit and smart growth and energy independence. There are a number of things happening in that regard, and we'll continue to be engaged with that to support it with grant funds and our time and interest.
And any chance that some of those programs might be expanded?
I hope so. It's very much the funds that EPA have are very much set by Congress. So if Congress sees fit to move those through to us, we're happy. For example, Congress funds the Diesel Emission Reduction Act, and we use those funds here in Hawaii to replace old dirty diesel engines in school buses.
And then one thought before we leave. I know that there's been a change in the notification of the public whenever there's high bacterial counts along the shoreline. And I know that was an issue, I believe, about a year ago. Share your thoughts about where we're going with that.
It's incredibly important. Not only is there a federal law, so-called Beach Act, but there are very engaged citizen groups here that want to work with Department of Health Services to ensure that everybody has information about beach water quality before we take our families into the water, and that people can have access to that information. So we need to continue to build that. Some of that is available now, and I think we're going to continue to strengthen that program with Department of Health Services.
Okay. Well, thank you, Alexis Strauss, for spending time with us.
Thank you so much.
Strauss winds up her trip to Hawaii this week, and you can listen back to the story on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. We'll be right back.
Most of us are familiar with the famous Hawaii Five-O theme song composed by Morton Stevens. The song was originally recorded by the musical group The Ventures as an instrumental theme for the long-running police procedural drama. It became such a hit it wound its way all the way to the United Kingdom. The dance floor scene of the late 1960s mod scene had been given way to the soul funk sound, and at the time, America had a fascination with Hawaiian culture back in the 50s and 60s. It was being reflected in movies, TV shows, and music, so much so that one group decided to add lyrics to this theme song. The Australian rock band Radio Birdman covered it in 1978 under the title Aloha, Steve and Dano, and added lyrics that examined people's dependence on art. Many of those lyrics were pulled directly from early episodes of the show, including its popular catchphrase, Book 'em Dano. The song went on to be covered by two more artists, Don Ho and the name we were looking for, Sammy Davis Jr.
And Chris, that one stumped both you and I, but
yes,
it didn't stump Mary Ann Oros from Kaneohe. Congratulations to you, our winner of today's quiz. That is today's quiz, and if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, helping to prepare students for the SBA exam with topical content and practice for the types of questions found on the test. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Writers have always used their craft to try to understand who we are and why we act the way we do, and often find themselves struggling to understand the opposite sex. Pat Matsueta is a co-editor of Ms. Align 2, a collection of works by women writers that adopt the male point of view. She's with us in our studio. Good morning, Pat.
Yes, hi, good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is an interesting idea. How'd you folks come up with it?
About 4 years ago, I was on a panel of women writers, and we were speaking to an audience about 100 people.
Uh-huh.
So we were at a conference held annually by a writers association, and we were appearing on the very first day, a Thursday, that is the first day of the conference, at 9 a.m. in the morning.
Uh-huh.
So we were one of the first events. And as I looked at people filing in, I saw that, as you know, might be expected, there were many women, but there were also men in the audience. And I felt so warmly towards them, mm-hmm, because they must have had some worry about coming to hear such a presentation. And I assured them we were not going to criticize men, that our goal was to share the writing we had done about men in an effort to reach out to them.
And they were curious.
Yes, they were. And they were also very well behaved.
Well, I'm refreshing to hear that. But we're curious about each other. And don't you think that writers kind of use, as I said in that intro, kind of use their craft to try to understand the things that they're writing about?
Yes, certainly that's true. Just yesterday, I was thinking about John Gardner. I don't know if you've read him. He was a fiction writer. Unfortunately, he died prematurely. But he was also a literary critic, and he wrote a very important book called On Moral Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I and many other writers have been influenced by it. And in it, he said that writers write to heal a wound. He says there's a moral wound, which is inherent in the nature of life itself, and writers write to heal that wound. So I think...
Wow. A moral wound.
Yeah.
Kind of almost a sense of original sin, sounds like.
Yes, that's true. I didn't think of it that way. Of course, the first men in the lives of women are fathers.
Right.
And I don't think it's a coincidence that some of the women, or many of the women in the editions of Misaligned, have had absent fathers or fathers who went to war and came back very troubled, mm-hmm. you know, and so forth. So in a sense, that is the wound that we are trying to heal. First, we start with our fathers, trying to communicate with them, and then we try to communicate with husbands, friends, and even the people we work with.
Well, that's our primary source of understanding of the opposite sex. For the boy child, it's our mothers. It's the girl child, it's the father. And we tend to have that experience, whatever conclusions we've reached about the opposite sex in childhood, about the opposite sex parents, they tend to stay with us.
Yes, that's true. There is a woman named Cassandra Rich, who's a black woman in her 40s, and she published an essay in the first edition about the lynching of her great-grandfather.
Wow.
And it's scary to think that lynching still happened in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Well, but, into the...
Right. So she talks about the ways in which this lynching affected the family, even her. You know, it became part of the family's legacy.
Sure.
Yeah. So...
Powerful stuff.
Oh, very powerful. In the second edition of the book, she has a wonderful essay called Day of Venus, in which she talks about going to the art museum with her son. And they see a statue of Venus, and she looks at it. She realizes she's not white, she's not beautiful, she's not curvaceous, and so forth. And she realizes that her son, by looking at the statue, is internalizing these ideas of femininity.
And finding that his mother does not... is not consistent with the,
yes.
the idea of beauty that we're fed.
That's right.
The Venus de Milo, the,
right,
the
exactly.
white woman, the curvaceous, as you said.
So she realizes that part of raising her son will involve the effort of complicating, let's say, his idea of womanhood, that it will become an idea that includes women like her.
Yeah. Well, there's some deprogramming involved because society is not pushing him, the boy child, in that direction.
Oh, exactly. I think that's one of the values of the Misaligned Project.
Yeah.
We've done two books now, and we'll be working on a third. But I'm hoping that people will find it gives a more subtle, a more surprising, a more moving representation of the interactions between males and females, that we affect each other not only in relationships but also in terms of forming our own identities, our own gender identities,
which are being more and more seen as fluid, that we don't necessarily have to choose between being a G.I. Joe or being a Barbie, right?
Yes, that's right. I think another value of the series is that, especially in this time when men are being accused of terrible things, you know, the Me Too movement and so mm-hmm. forth, I think it's important to remember that the men who are, you know, so-called bad ones are a minority, and the majority of men are good, and they're willing to sit down and talk with women, listen to what they have to say, and then... together, working together, they can modify each other's behavior and produce a better society, better family, better community.
Well, both men and women have been pretty taken aback by the revelations of the last 6 months, haven't they?
Right, yes. In some ways they've been good, in other ways they've been toxic, I think.
Well, it's certainly, you know, it's refreshing to point in the direction of the men we don't hear about, the non-abusive men who, as you said, are the majority. I hope that's true.
Oh, yes, I'm sure it's true. You know, we're all fragile human beings. We have the potential for great good. So hopefully works like Misaligned can help us bring out those parts.
Well, literature has played a role in moving us toward our potential, don't you think?
Oh, yes, certainly. That's one of the main functions of writing, and that's what John Gardner talks about in his book. As he says, we write for the good opinion of good people, and in doing so, you know, we try to become good ourselves.
What's the name of that book again? I want to remember that. That's
It's a fantastic book on moral fiction.
On moral fiction.
It's been criticized by some people for being kind of rigid, but it's a wonderful book.
Well, it's all part of this project, which we've been talking about, Women Writing About Men. The book is Misaligned 2, and it's poems, short stories, and essays.
Yes, that's right.
Must have been a job of work to gather them together.
Yes, it was quite an ordeal.
But it's an ongoing project?
It is, yes. We're hoping to have events like, you know, talks, readings, and so forth. But the idea is to gather more people into our community.
Well, I wish you luck. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
Pat Matsueta is the co-editor of Ms. Aligned, Women Writing About Men, which came out in 2017. She's also the managing editor of Manoa, a literary journal published twice a year by UH Press.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
Hi, this is Jason Taglianetti. One of the highlights of my time here at HPR was being the recording engineer for Aloha Shorts. You may remember that weekly program of local literature read by Hawaii's actors, and you may have heard of its famously fun live tapings. Now you have a chance to experience the best of Aloha Shorts live at the Palikū Theater for one night only on August 11th. Tickets are on sale now at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Le Jardin Academy.
And that's it for this week on The Conversation. Coming up next week, we'll look at the volcano's impact on tourism.
We'd like to hear from you. Call our talkback line. Leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, our links to more information, go to the Conversation page on the HPR website. The program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finity, and Amber Khan Grusby.
The Backyard Quiz theme written by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday and pick up the conversation.